It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air this Friday, we are just 11 days away from the Illinois primary election. Voting is actually already underway. With the presidential primaries all but decided for both major parties, the down-ballot races are where votes will really count. But a new analysis out this week from the nonprofit news outlet Capital News Illinois found close to 9 out of 10 primary elections in Illinois for judicial and state legislative races have either just one candidate or no candidates. That is the most uncompetitive primary for those roles in at least 20 years. Here to talk about it in our politics roundtable is Andrew Adams, state government reporter based in Chicago for Capital News Illinois. Andrew, welcome to the 21st show, I think for the first time.
Thanks for having me, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here.
So if I'm doing the math right, just what, 12% of these judicial and state legislative primaries are contested this year? Talk about how that compares to the past couple of decades.
Sure thing. So the primaries this year are superlative. They are the least competitive they've been since 2004, which is as far back as our analysis goes. But it's always been fairly low. It ranges from between 1 in 4 to 1 in 5 primaries that are actually competitive. This year just happens to be kind of a new low for that, which is about 1 in 8.
1 in 8. Wow. Okay. So let's get into why that is. You talked in your piece to John Shaw, who's director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University Carbondale. What is his theory or maybe hypothesis as to why competition is so limited?
Sure. It's a multifaceted question, right? So there are lots of different trends, both at the state and national level, that go into this issue. John told me that two of the big ones are the increased polarization across the board from federal government on down, and at the state level, districting. So how the legislative maps are drawn, how the judicial districts are drawn, they tend to be drawn by the party in power at the end of a decade, which in Illinois has been the Democratic Party for 30, 40 years. And they draw maps in such a way that decreases competition for non-incumbents, which means that people who aren't already in office will have a more challenging time running against someone that is in office. And that's not to mention the partisan element of this as well, where districts are drawn to massively favor Democrats or massively favor Republicans, so that there are very few with kind of a 50-50 split.
You always get these great stories. I remember, I think it was 20 years ago, there was a guy who had challenged a congressman in downstate. And when the maps were redrawn, it literally just like went, they moved the line so that his house was across the street from the district boundary. So you're right. They definitely do sometimes do shenanigans for protecting incumbents, which that can be a bipartisan thing. You know, we have talked on our program about polarization in the political process and within the parties and how that's affected moderate candidates. You talked about this with John Jackson, another professor at the Paul Simon Institute, about that. What did he have to say about how that is affecting the primaries here?
Of course. John Jackson told me a couple things in this realm. Number one, like you said, it's become much more partisan. So people are motivated more by ideology, more by allegiance to kind of some partisan party rather than any kind of governance or a local level. And part of that, Jackson told me, was due to the declining power of parties at the local level. So in yesteryear, parties might have a very transactional, very material kind of exchange for people in the district, in the ward, if you're in the city of Chicago, where the party might help folks get jobs, the party might intervene with constituent services for people, leading to most people having less of an ideological tie to their party and more of a material one. But as things have shifted to become more partisan, people are motivated by ideology, and they that creates a system for these parties where if you don't align with kind of the furthest elements of your party in the primary, you won't do well.
And it's another, well, I mean, one of the other consequences of that, for example, is that you don't see, say, Democrats running in farm country very much, at least on the primary ballots. How does that fit into what we've been talking about?
Sure. There's a definite geographic split in Illinois that has become more pronounced over time. And even if you look at this year's primary, you'll find that there are essentially no competitive Republican primaries in the city of Chicago and essentially no competitive Democratic primaries downstate. And even in the cases where there's a single person running in the primary that's kind of projected to lose in the general election, so maybe there's a single Democrat running in a downstate House district, that person is likely going to lose. So there's not a lot of attention paid. There's not a lot of money spent in those races because everyone kind of knows it's already going to go to one party or the other.
Yeah. You know, there's a remarkable, I don't know if you call it like a stat or fact in your story, that there is exactly one state House district where both of the main parties have a competitive primary. It's the 76th House district around DeKalb. What's going on there?
Sure. So that district is, like you said, centered on DeKalb. Its current representative, Lance Yednock, is not running for re-election. And that district is sort of unique because it contains DeKalb, which is sort of a college town, a mid-sized city within central DeKalb, kind of tends towards Democratic voters. But then it also includes large chunks of kind of rural DeKalb County and some of the surrounding area, which tend to go more towards Republicans. It's one of the few districts that's even drawn in such a way that could be competitive.
And the last thing I want to talk to you about in about a minute and a half we have remaining are judicial elections. What are you seeing there? I understand, you know, last time around we had these big Supreme Court races that were sucking up a lot of attention. This year there is another Supreme Court case, but not a single Republican running there. What is the big story in judicial elections this year?
Sure. So, like you said, there's one primary for a Supreme Court seat, but that's in Cook County, which is a Democratic stronghold and has been for many years. But even around the state, these judicial elections tend to show the same level of competitiveness as legislative elections. And downstate, you're seeing a lot of rural districts where most people are Republicans anyway. So most judges are Republicans and people who don't necessarily pay close attention to judicial elections, might just be voting their party in the general because they're unfamiliar with the races. Kind of the longer term view on judicial elections are that counterintuitively, they're staying kind of similarly competitive over time. Coincidentally, another superlative year again for judicial elections, least competitive in the time span we looked at, although, you know, still roughly similar levels of competitiveness. Although in some areas of the state, notably Cook County, which operates a very large court system, judicial elections are getting more attention from voters. More people are paying attention to them as candidates who might be influential in policy and judicial decisions, and more media attention is being spent on these elections. So it's an interesting space to watch.
And we appreciate you keeping an eye on it. Andrew Adams is Chicago-based state government reporter for Capital News Illinois. We will have a link to his analysis of Illinois primary elections on our website, 21stshow.org. Andrew, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Brian.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we're going to turn our attention now to the national political scene. With us to talk about that, as always, is Linda Kenyon, who covers the Congress for Illinois Public Media. Linda, good to be talking with you.
Well, thank you, Brian. Always happy to be here.
Now, I should mention briefly, in order to make our schedules meet, Linda and I spoke on Thursday, midday. By the time you hear this, of course, President Biden will have given his State of the Union address. There's going to be a lot of analysis about that, both the substance and the theatrics. Plenty of outlets where you can hear that, including this public radio station on other programs. But, you know, we're not going to be talking in the past tense about an event that is still in the future for us. So we will spend our time on other topics today. And Linda, let's start on Groundhog Day again. There was talk this week about the threat of another partial government shutdown. In one of its stories, Reuters, I like this, they said, Congress is over 5 months late in accomplishing its most basic task of passing full-year government funding measures. As we are recording this, the Republican-controlled House passed a substantial spending bill without a large swath of Republicans voting for it. In fact, all three Republicans from Illinois, Representatives Bost, LaHood, and Miller, all voted no on this. What did it take? What did it take for House Speaker Johnson to get this through?
Well, I will say from the very beginning, before we even get to Speaker Johnson and how he had to sort of twist some arms and bend some elbows, your reaction, your comment about Groundhog Day, it's been referred to as the annual circus on Capitol Hill, where you get one continuing resolution after another after another. And the quote from Mark Twain, which is one of my personal favorites, which says, "History may not repeat itself, but it often rhymes." So there we go. He also said, I don't know if I should say this, but he also said, "Suppose you were a member of Congress, or suppose you were an idiot, but I repeat myself."
We're definitely leaving that in.
Mark Twain had a very healthy discontent with the congressional process, and he is often quoted on Capitol Hill. So, be that as it may, Speaker Johnson knew that he needed a lot of Democratic support in order to pass the continuing resolution, or the CR, and that's exactly what he got. And essentially, it was, an overwhelming bipartisan vote. It was 339 to 85. Democrats did most of the heavy lifting with 207 yes votes. Only 132 Republicans voted for it. And that was after Speaker Johnson basically said to his members, especially his members of the conservative House Freedom Caucus, that a government shutdown was not going to look good for Republicans because they are in control of the House. And in an election year, not looking good for Republicans is an especially bad thing for Republicans who are seeking re-election. So he gave them that sort of stern warning. Now, members of the House Freedom Caucus were particularly discontented with the conservative, with the lack of attention to their conservative viewpoints. For example, they wanted more across-the-board spending cuts. They also wanted a number of policy riders that would state their positions on various legislative and social issues, not the least of which would have been, for example, abortion. And Speaker Johnson reminded them that doing something like that would put the continuing resolution in jeopardy because it would still have to be passed by the Senate. And the Senate was not going to condone any of those policy riders, which are often referred to up on Capitol Hill as poison pills. So with the overwhelming bipartisan majority of passage in the House, it then went on to the U.S. Senate.
And again, we're recording this Thursday. There may be news on this by the time listeners are hearing it midday Friday. But, you know, just a couple of minutes left. Government agencies have now been functioning on these temporary spending bills for so long. What sort of meaningful changes would there be to actually get a full permanent or, you know, budget, at least for the fiscal year?
There'd be a lot of changes that would have to happen, but mostly it would have to happen at the polls, at the ballot box. because those folks who are elected and or reelected every year, every 2 years, every 6 years, depending on House or Senate, are very much at odds with each other. And their ability to work together is hampered year after year after year. And so, by the way, according to the Congressional Research Service, in all but three of 47 years since the start of the fiscal year was changed from July 1st to October 1st in 1978, CRs were needed almost every single year, continuing resolutions. So that means that this lack of agreement, both in substance and in policy, have been really with us, for most of us, for our entire lives. So that's a pretty big lift in order to change that kind of psyche up on Capitol Hill.
Making the abnormal normal.
Yes.
Well, Linda Kenyon, I appreciate you being normal with us here on the 21st show. Thank you for your time. And since we are, again, back in time, you have to cover the State of the Union this evening. Good luck with that. Hope it's not too late a night for you.
Well, we're expecting at least until about 1 a.m. Eastern, so we'll be busy tonight.
All right. Thank you, and well, in advance, have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Before we go to the break, I should mention that on Monday's program, we're going to be talking about a new book. As our weather is getting wilder, our water is getting wilder as well. Floods more intense and more frequent. We'll talk with environmental writer and photographer Tim Palmer, who reflects on what we can do about it in his book, Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. That's all coming up Monday on the 21st show. After the break, we'll be talking about old movie theaters and vaudeville stages finding new life as nonprofits. This is the 21st show. Stay with us.